This is the Cinema for All podcast,
a celebration of going to the cinema
with Jack Chell and Abby Standish.
Welcome to the Cinema for All podcast. We're your hosts, Jack Chell
and Abby Standish,
and we're part of the Cinema for All team. It's another mini-sode today.
Yay!
Yeah, Abby and Rosie went out to interview British filmmaker Carol Morley about her new film Out of Blue. We are so lucky and excited that we've been able to bring you so many interviews with filmmakers. So thanks to our friends at the showroom and Organic Publicity for helping us get these great filmmakers. Our most recent one was with Border director Ali Abbasi, so check that out. But there's loads in the archive. We've got Steve Loveridge, who directed the MIA doc. We've got Felipe Bustos Sierra, who directed the Nepasaran film, which is a brilliant yeah. film. So loads and loads of stuff to get your teeth into. So check them all out.
Carol Morley was such a delight and joy to interview. We both genuinely felt enriched after our conversation.
Oh.
She talked about films, who influences her, about friendship, authenticity, all our favourite words in the world.
Yeah.
And her new film, Out of Blue, is quite linked to kind of what she does. It's quite investigative, but this is an all-out detective drama. Patricia Clarkson plays...
Oh, I love Patricia Clarkson.
Oh, yeah. We love Patricia Clarkson. And we've seen her in a way we've never seen her as Detective Mike Houlihan. And she kind of uncovers stuff about her past through a recent case. And it's really, really great for if you like a thriller kind of cop drama. But there's so much more going on than that. It's kind of a little bit mystical. It's a little bit scientific. Really, really good. Excellent performances. And New Orleans is just a wonderful place to be when you're watching a film.
Fantastic. I'm so excited to see this one. I'm so excited to listen to this interview that you and Rosie did. So let's get into it.
Hope you enjoy it.
So me and Abby both absolutely loved the film. Can you talk a little bit about what drew you to the story?
Well, it's because it is a radical adaptation of the Martin Amis book. And Luke Rogue, who co-produced The Falling, my last film, with Cairo Cannon, his dad is Nicholas Rogue, or was, because he sadly died.
Yeah.
But he'd always wanted to make Night Train into a film. And so Luke had the option on it, and he said, do you want to read it? And now people wouldn't put me together with Martin Amis. So, and I'd never thought I'd want to adapt a Martin Amis book necessarily. Mm. But I read it, and it was the themes of cosmology and the female detective. And I sort of got really drawn into that. And then I said to Luke, would I have to... work within with Martin Amis, because if you work with the writer you feel like you should honor their exact intentions. He said no, you could run with it, which is what I did. So it is quite a departure from the books. I didn't want to illustrate it, but yeah, I love this idea of one woman being connected to this other woman she didn't know, Jennifer, who dies.
Yeah.
We know she dies right from the beginning. It's not a spoiler. And that there's this kind of sense of them circling each other. So I like that mystery to them both in a way.
Yeah, and I think you're constantly changing your opinion on how they're connected as well.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many different connections that I was kind of putting together between the characters.
Yeah, you and Ellie asked me in the office in the scene, and you were like, and what do you think so far? And I'm like, well, these are my theories. And then 10 minutes in, my theories have changed.
Yeah.
Well, you see, I really love that, because I think you become, as the audience, you become the detectives.
Mm.
And I think a detective has to piece together, and they're not always right. And it's there always is a sense of themselves in it, that you have to put yourselves in it when you watch a film. So I think there's something quite sort of parallel to being an audience member and being the detective.
Definitely. Yeah.
So I love that you had all these theories.
Yeah, we did. Maybe we'll go through them later if we've got time.
One by one.
And the film is full of amazing actors. Mamie Gummer, Patricia Clarkson, Toby Jones. These are some serious gets. What was it like to work with these actors?
I think at the point you meet them and you're working with them, you see them as your characters.
Right.
So there's something interesting about that, because you're like working with James Caan, who played Colonel Tom.
Yeah.
I wasn't really meeting James Caan. I'm meeting my character that I've written. So it's the intimidation goes down somehow. But you're still aware that he, for example, using James Caan, he tells his Marlon Brando stories. So sometimes you have to pinch yourself. And somebody like... Patricia Clarkson, that caliber of acting, extraordinary acting, and bringing that role to life was really exciting. And I think from the moment I met her and spoke to her first before I met her, but from that moment, I just felt the film was a reality and that Mai could come to life beyond anything you could ever write. And I think, again, you know, she was Patricia Clarkson, but she was Mike. It's really weird.
Yeah, we were saying she's so distinctive. Her voice and her look is so distinctive in cinema. It was so interesting to see her in this role where she's really kind of in a shadow almost. And it was just really, really... I thought that was a nice play on some of the themes in the film. I don't want to spoil anything.
Well, and also with Patricia, I think, because she, you know, in real life, she's blonde.
Yeah.
She long hair, very distinctive. But in this, it sort of takes her into more of, I guess, a gothic kind of look, more of a somebody that likes Joan Jett, as said in the film, Are You Joan Jett? Or Patti Smith, and this dark hair. And I wanted her to be kind of an opposite of Jennifer. Mm-hmm. So that Jennifer, who dies in the film, the astrophysicist, is the blonde, seemingly perfect, and then Mike is an opposite to that. It was sort of fascinating, but Patricia takes that on brilliantly, and I think that isn't quite recognisable, I think, as Patricia Clarkson. I mean, every actor brings themselves to it, but I think she sort of goes beyond how I've ever seen her in a role, and all the better for it, because she's really exciting.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You don't know what's going to get unlocked. It's so unexpected every minute. It's really, really good. Is there any other kind of really great female actors that's on your dream list to work with?
All of them.
Yeah, that's good. Busy.
I think, you know, I sometimes think I'd love to work with, like, Glenda Jackson. Mm-hmm. I saw, you know, because she hasn't done a lot of films for years. And then I saw her in Leah in the theatre recently. And she's, I think, 80, 81. And I thought, oh, I'd love to work with her. I'd love to work with her. And I think I'd love to work with Maxine Peake again, because she's my muse. I love her.
Incredible.
But people that I haven't met yet, there's so many. But I think that ultimately you've got to go, who is my character, and work that way. Mm-hmm. Without Blue, the only role I wrote for somebody was the Toby Jones character, Ian Strami, because Ian Strami isn't in the book, but it's an anagram of Martin Amis's name. I'd always thought of him as Toby Jones. So that was the only one, but I'd feel quite scared to write it for particular people in case you couldn't get them.
Yeah.
But there are so many brilliant actors out there. But you never know what will reveal itself from your characters. Who else would I like to work with? Probably like Cate Blanchett.
Yeah.
Samantha Morton as well. Lots of British actors, American actors, all over really. So yeah, it's probably my wish list would be millions, thousands anyway.
Samantha Morton seems like such a good fit. Definitely.
She has an intensity.
Yeah.
I mean, Jodie Foster doesn't do that much anymore. But when I was growing up, I loved Jodie Foster. Mm-hmm. And I think she has a certain intensity and something beyond what you see. Yeah. I always like that. You feel that there's more going on than what you know.
Oh, yeah. Clarice Signs of the
Land. Fantastic.
A lot of your films actually, interestingly, have an investigative element, kind of whether it's surface level or kind of underneath. What was it, did it seem like a natural step to do something that is an out and out detective story?
I think it must have done. It's weird because sometimes you forget what you felt like before you did it, and you start to make not assumptions about why you did it, but it's almost like it seems like that. But you asked me that question and it seems like absolutely, you know, but I can't honestly vouch for how I felt at the beginning. But I think that Dreams of a Life was the investigation into Joyce Vincent, who lay dead in her flat at 38 for 3 years before being discovered. And that detective work around that. And in The Falling, there's a kind of detection. So you're quite right. I think I do like that film can reveal itself as a detective story, even if it doesn't seem like one on the surface. Again, going back to that idea that we as the audience are all part of piecing it together. And I'm very drawn to things that are hidden and secrets and somehow revealing stuff behind that. Mm-hmm. Why are things secret? And not in terms of like destroying someone's privacy, which I think is quite different. And I think a lot of tabloid stuff that it seems like detective work isn't really, it's just destroying someone's privacy. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm more interested in, possibly especially with Out of Blue as well, the kind of detective work around somebody's mind and why they see what they see.
Yeah, really interesting.
And do what they do, you know.
Yeah, great. So I think this is your first film set in America.
Yes.
And it kind of felt like New Orleans played a sort of subtle but really distinctive character in the film.
Yeah.
I just wondered if you could talk a bit about kind of why you changed.
Well, in the book isn't set anyway. It's set in America, but it's set in a... second tier American city, whatever that means. But that's the Martin Amis thing, I think. And then I set it in Atlanta, which is in Georgia. I wanted to do it in the South because I was interested in this idea in the South of hiding the past. And there you get a lot of statues taken off the plinths.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're trying to reinvent what's happened in their past with enslaved people and all of that. And then so I set it there. Patricia came on board, then she was in Sharp Objects, which was filmed mostly in LA, but she filmed a bit in Atlanta, and she phoned me up and she went, we can't film here, it's too busy, we'll never get any crew. I've never forgotten it, she went, I'll never get anyone to do my hair apart from a dog groomer. That was like that big line. And she went, what about moving it to New Orleans? Because she knew that New Orleans had just introduced its tax credits again.
Right.
They'd gone. And you need them to make independent films. You need it for your budget. And she is from New Orleans. Patricia's from. So her accent is authentic. Yeah. And I think we think, and the accents in New Orleans are very varied. They didn't like, when I spoke to people, they didn't like the films where Southern accents are really pronounced because that are set in New Orleans because they don't feel that's accurate. So that sort of excited me that we would take Patricia, a New Orleanian from birth and brought up, back to her city as Mike. And it was always my intention that Mike was... reflected it well, quite rightly what you said before, but subtly, but reflected in the city that she's hiding stuff as the city is, and repressing stuff as the city is. So then that link became even stronger.
It's just great seeing something like set in the South like that, like a story like that. It gives you like Truman Capote vibes. Like there's something that it's very friendly. It's like a glass of iced tea, but there's something underneath that you're going to get to that has a different identity, like Chicago or New York, where you're used to seeing these films maybe set.
Yeah, it's true. And also the New Orleanian thing as well. I didn't want to, I suppose it's like when we see films of England or, you know, even Sheffield or Manchester or London, and there's things in it that are so cliched.
Yeah.
So maybe with England, it'd be the red phone box and the red bus or, you know, and they're always there and you just go, yeah, but that isn't what we all see every day necessarily. Yeah. And I think with New Orleans, I wanted to make sure as well that it was how we often inhabit a city. And in America, they really hardly get out of their cars. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want these big vistas, really. I wanted, like, with Mike in that car so that you're not always getting this great view. Oh, isn't that tremendous view of the river? I mean, there is a river in it, but it kind of seeps in it. The Mississippi isn't like this big, like, I don't know, helicopter shot of it or something.
Yeah.
So it's seeing it as we piece together our lives. And I think maybe that's why the character comes through, because it's coming through Mike.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Rather than me like showing it off, like, look, this great crane shot.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Something
that we both found really interesting is that Detective Hoolan seems to be a queer woman in the film, but this wasn't pivotal to the plot, which is obviously quite rare in films. And we really enjoyed seeing a queer character kind of in that way. Can you tell us a little bit about
it? Well, I think that's a really good point, because I think they're not knocking them in any way, but you can often get lesbian and gay films that are all about, or queer films, or whatever, or that are all about coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, and actually, or all about sex,
mm-hmm. yeah.
or, you know, or maybe getting, a, you know, into a relationship or whatever. So I did feel that actually to have a character that is not explicitly explaining her mm-hmm. sexuality, but at the same time, it's the film takes place over about 10 days. They're not having sex during that period because they're quite busy.
Yeah. She's got a lot to do.
She's got a lot to do. But at the same time, not kind of, because I think that sexuality for me isn't defined by necessarily who you have sex with.
Yeah,
it's not,
yeah.
you know, and often it can get very confused in that way. So I thought she's very, you know, as you know, there's a scene where she goes to a strip club.
Yeah.
And that, and then you see her with some other women in that context, and she kisses one of them very briefly. But even that isn't like trying to indicate anything. But but for me and for Patricia, there was this sense of what she was about.
Yeah.
And that would be a part of it without, like you say, being overt. And I think it's important that not, if someone's heterosexual in a film, or in TV or in a book, they don't always have to go and have sex or talk about
That's
it all the time
saying,
or be revealing it all the time. So I like that you can not have to kind of see every character who's, you know, from a queer background being expressively sexual all the time.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was really refreshing actually because it just didn't drive the plot in any way. Yeah. It was just part of her character.
Yeah.
Same way, like, I drive this car, I have this car.
I live with the cat.
Yeah, I live with the cat. MVP. Yeah.
And also, I think it's important as well that not every character in a film, especially a woman, has to be after a relationship.
Yes.
You know, because so many roles with women there, they won't be complete until, you know, living on your own doesn't mean you're lonely, you know, or it doesn't mean you want to live with someone. It doesn't mean you want to be with someone. So I think often a kind of Hollywoodization, I suppose, or a romanticization is that you're after the other part of you.
Yeah, that's the biggest call to adventure. That's what I was just going to say, that I think that's what really drew me to the film even more. Like, I'm always there for a good detective story, but I loved how it had loads of elements that I'm really keen to see. Like, it was a female detective, it's a female director, the character may be queer, maybe not. And I think what was good is that they're all there, they still are a really big part of this person's identity and what's making the story in a sense, but they're all just playing the same role as everything else. And I thought that you just so rarely see that. It is always sort of a cause or a reason.
Yeah.
Or a driving force. And it was nice to see that, because like you say, if it's a male character or a heterosexual character, they're not like, let's establish this.
Yeah, I know,
it's just,
they're
it's
not.
Just happening.
It's just a given, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just a given. And definitely. You're like, and you know, and often a guy, you know, that might be a love interest, but it's usually a sort of titillation for a scene or two. Mm-hmm. They're not very significant and they don't really want them. It's not like my life will be complete if I get married. It's just like, you know, I'm a guy.
Now you know. We've cleared that up. Definitely. I really loved the friendships as well between her and her colleagues. I thought that was really amazing because it's this woman who's quite hidden and seems to like to be a lone wolf, and that's how she operates. But the care that seems to reflect from one another, I thought that was quite unique. It wasn't like, we're in an office, do you know?
I know. Yeah. Well, I think friendship in our society is undervalued as well.
Yes.
And I think friendships, not, you know, not like a hen night friendships, but a kind of, you know, of like, we'll be your bridesmaids.
Yeah.
But more like, I think that everyday connection to people that isn't necessarily, they might not know tons about you, but they're aware of you and you're in their lives. And I really like that about, you know, I do like that about the film, about these friendships that are just sort of ticking away. And and they are noticing something's amiss with her, but they're not necessarily prying too much because she wouldn't like it. And her friendships are with men and women. Of course, she meets a new friend in it. Stella
Hunnid.
Yeah, mystery friend. So the connections she makes are deeper than just being about a stepping stone to somewhere else you want to be. They exist in the integrously, I think, in her life, even with her cat.
Yeah,
you know,
they felt realistic. Yeah. The moments where they were offering, were concerned about you. Yeah. People don't usually do that straight away.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just really nice and natural. Yeah. Really good to see.
So, what's next for you? Do you have any projects?
I do. Yes. So I got this Welcome Fellowship. So they're like a scientific organization, but not like of the stars and cosmology, but sort of health. And it's like they used to be called medical science. I mean, they used to talk about biomedical science, but health is an easier way to get in. Anyway, while I was doing this screenwriting fellowship, that I came across with the librarians in the archive, this massive archive of 80 huge boxes. I'm doing this with my hands, which is useless, on a podcast.
We see it.
Very large, very large. Imagine very large. It was of a woman called Audrey Amies, who'd been born in 1933 in Sunderland, and she, in her 50s, had gone to the Royal Academy of Arts in London to study painting. And while she was there, which is how it came to be in the Wellcome Trust later, but while she was there, she had a breakdown and ended up in a mental hospital, as they were called then, in the psychiatric hospital. And never returned to her studies. And she became a revolving door psychiatric patient entire life. But she was really funny. And she left behind beautiful painting sketches. Her nephew and niece went in her flat and they found 50,000 sketches, diaries, letter logs. So she'd write a ton of letters every day, but log them. So she'd go, wrote a letter to the Sherlock Holmes Society today about my missing sock.
Wow.
And she knew she was funny. She loved music. So she'd be listening like in her 70s to Elba. She'd write about Boy George. And she kept scrapbooks of everything she ever ate, the wrappers, and annotated them. And so I got really obsessed, met the family. So that's what I'm working on now. So it'll be like a radical biopic, but it'll be her life told through her eyes, not someone looking at someone with mental health difficulties or diagnosed with them, because she would dispute she had them. I mean, that's the other thing. So I really make sure now I don't say a schizophrenic, I say somebody who was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Yeah, yeah.
I've really become conscious of that, because you're not all the diagnosis anyway, even if you feel it's you.
Yeah.
That's what I'm working on. And what's really weird is that she had a thing about connection. So she would often do word association and make connections. And what's strange is I've gone from Martin Amis with one S to Audrey Amis with two S's. So she would see a connection from Amis to Amis. Okay.
That's nice. It's nice to carry with you into that project.
So again, it's like, it's detective work in a way, but it's the opposite of Dreams of Life in that I've been left with so much archive, so much material. But it's detective work to look through it and piece together a film, because you have to construct it and make it obviously a lot shorter.
Yeah.
But you're trying, so I'm trying to, in everything I do in the new one and in Out of Blue, just create some authenticity.
Yeah.
It's not social realism, it's quite imaginative, or, it's not like I need it to look real, but I do like that thing about being authentic somehow.
Yeah, I think it lasts with people longer when that is present, and it's kind of that thing you can't quite articulate, but you feel it. In a film, that's really.
I'm liking what you say.
Yeah, I'm liking what you're doing. Are there any characters in films that you particularly love, or directors you particularly love?
Oh yeah, now all the things like that always get I remember this is when I always forget film titles. This is when I'm like, you know that film with that woman in it, and I like.
Quite mean of us, because we wouldn't know.
One of the films I think I thought of a lot, I just think of a lot, is the Charles Laughton film, Night of the Hunter, and Charles Laughton. And it's a brilliant film and I love it. And it's just so fascinating in so many ways. But one of the things I think about is Charles Laughton never made another film after that, because he was heartbroken that nobody liked it. Not the audience or the critics. It did really badly. So I always think of that, because I think of that in terms of my own films and thinking, like you were saying, things can last, you know, and that's preferable to someone liking something and then it disappearing to me. And I do make things, films for people to like, but I'm always conscious that they might not, and that's okay. And a big inspiration from the very beginning was Jane Campion. And I think with Sweetie, it's one of my favourite films. With Sweetie, she was crying afterwards in Cannes because it got booed, you know. So it's like that really odd thing that I look at films and go, they're so brilliant. Then you look back at the history of it and go, it wasn't like accepted in that way. You know, there's so many filmmakers I love. I mean, in Britain, we've got Lynn Ramsey, mm-hmm. we've got Clive Bernard, we've got I Can't Wait to See the new film from Joanna Hogg.
Yeah.
And also our Andrea Arnold.
Also
Andrea Arnold. I think the work she does is so absolutely brilliant. And it's different than the work I make. And I'm so excited this is all coming out of Britain. These women writing their own material and directing it, which I think is really great. And I do like people. I mean, like the falling, I was sort of connected to Picnic Hanging Rock in my mind. And Peter Weir, I think, is an amazing director because I like directors that aren't flashy.
Yeah.
That are kind of going through the story and the look of it and the feel of it and the sounds and everything are integral to the story that they're telling. They're not sort of putting over stylizing it.
Yeah, I always feel like those are the ones where, like, if you watched them on BBC Two late at night, you miss the beginning, so you don't know what it's called, and you go to the playground the next day, and, like, did you see that film where this happened?
Yeah. You're sort of totally in your mind. And Agnes Varda, of course, you know, Cleo from 5 to 7. Sometimes call it 9 to 5.
But
Cleo from 5 to 7 and Vagabond. Vagabond was very crucial to how I felt about Dreams of a Life as well, because she's looking at piecing together the life of a dead woman. So that was very instrumental. But I just have so many films. I have recently got addicted to Talking Pictures TV. Do you know that?
Oh, what's that?
It's on Freeview. I think it might be Channel 81. But talk about coming into a film in the middle, then you have to find that film.
Yeah.
And they'll do interviews and they're showing often B movies or old films and stuff that maybe aren't seen yet as important enough to have a cinema, you know, a retrospective of that work. And they just show amazing stuff and you'll see some actress that you don't know and you're looking her up and all sorts of stuff has gone on. You know, I've discovered all sorts of things from watching that channel.
81, man. Yeah. I'm getting it. Yeah.
Don't trust me on the 81. I think it is 81, but it's
Talking
Pictures TV. Mm-hmm. It's That's brilliant. Nice. And they'll take somebody that has been quite forgotten, really, an actress, say, and find her. Mm. She might be in her 80s and interview them for 20 minutes in the middle. Brilliant. So it's really good. It's really good.
That sounds brilliant. Yeah. I like the reason why you like Night of the Hunter. Yeah. It's such a cool film now. Yeah.
It's great. And you can't imagine what film, you know, everybody loves that film because it's got amazing characters, it enters darkness, it enters something about that we fear.
Yeah.
But maybe at the time it held up a mirror to people's sort of psyches or something.
A bit much.
Yeah.
Good time.
But it's so good.
Yeah. Good choices. Yeah.
although I couldn't remember them to start with.
Yeah,
I get that fear factor.
Our podcast is a celebration about going to the cinema, and we've noticed you've been tweeting lately about how great it would be to have a cinema in every town. Yeah. So I just wonder if you could tell us why you're passionate about that.
I mean, I haven't followed very diligently this whole streaming versus theatrical stuff that's gone on. But one of the things I've been thinking is that, you know, you could talk about the quality of seeing a film in the cinema, you know, if it is 35mm projection or the digital or the sound and all of that. But and that's true. But watching it at home has its other benefits. And people now have a kind of good setups, you know, and even if you're watching on an old TV, it can be fine. But so for me, the quality factor about TV or watching it on your computer and the cinemas isn't what I'm interested in. I'm more interested in the idea that when you go to a cinema or a public space, you are connecting with other people and it becomes a communal experience, which is very different. So I love the appetite for films, that people can see them and you can watch them on streaming now. I mean, it's great, that availability, but I don't think it beats going to the cinema And I felt, just because I'm doing this Q&A tour, as you know, you know, it was previewing Out of Blue. I've met like people and you realise that it's really crucial to them because maybe they're not going to necessarily go to a nightclub or a pub or, you know, so the context of a cinema or even bingo, you know, and where, you know, where else is there a mall? I don't know what else there is. A library, they're getting shut down. So I think that communal experience of everybody together sharing in something and is really, really important. And the problem with streaming for me is that while it's great and Netflix, yeah, they're great and everything, but if we continue down that line, we might close down cinemas because people will say, well, I'll just watch it like this and not go to a local cinema that's struggling. So we do need to support all cinemas. And then since I tweeted about cinemas, I've got a cinema for us, you know, sending pictures of all the a village hall cinema and setting them up in different spaces. And that is a cinema because a cinema is a film being projected and people gathering. So I think it's just really, really important and a great way of people sharing in something and talking about afterwards or being visible to other people. So what it does for a community is massive. And you might hate the film, but it doesn't matter because you had that experience and you probably end up talking about it with someone. Somebody tweeted and said, yeah, that he really remembered leaving a film he hated and talking to someone about it, and a stranger, and having a great conversation. So it's somewhere I think you can feel safe going on your own as well.
Yeah, definitely. We couldn't put it better ourselves, really. Definitely. Yeah. I think us growing up, we wouldn't be in like clubs or anything. Cinema would be like our night out.
Yeah, that's your night out. It's a great night
out.
It's
so good. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And Glenda Jackson actually is a patron of a film site. Yeah. So it's well connected, definitely. What are some of your favourite memories of going to the cinema, if you can recall any that kind of stood out to you, whether it's recent or...
I remember, so one time we... Not that we went... I never went to the cinema a lot, but I do remember we moved. It was the... Because my dad died when I was 11. He killed himself, so there we go. But it was the last house I ever lived in with him. And there was a cinema around the corner called the Savoy Cinema in Heaton Moor. We didn't live there very long. But I do remember before he died, my mum and him went to see Jaws. I would have loved to have seen that film, but I was too little. But I couldn't believe my mum fell asleep. But then I went to the Savoy. I went to the Savoy with my dad, and it must have been like a mat. It was really quiet. There weren't many people in there. And I said, "Can we go to the back? And could I lay on the floor?" He was quite strict, and he let me lay on the floor. And so I lay in the aisle like that kid. You want to lie down? Yeah. I lay in the aisle, and it was Bugsy Malone. Yeah. Wow. And so I really remembered that. It was really, really special because we didn't really do much together.
Yeah.
And so that was very sort of great memory that.
Definitely. Yeah. What a beautiful memory.
And it was Jodie Foster.
Oh, of course. Yeah, Tallulah. Was it like she went off and flew off and did Taxi Driver literally right off the back of that?
Exactly. She I think they were very close together, those two different characters.
Yeah. But
and I just remember loving the entire piece, you know, the entire film. So he's a great director. And I love the way he works with music and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Bugsy Malone. Kids being adults. Also, it's the same thing I felt when I saw Grease. Mm. Now, I think I was 12 or 13 when I saw Grease, and I went with my friend Lisa, and she brought a boy along with her. She was on a date. And I bought, it's terrible now to think about it, but I bought 10 Number 6 and smoked the lot while I was watching the film, because you could smoke in cinemas then, and I was trying to be kind of grown up and not be like, I don't care, you've got a boy sitting next to you and you're holding his hand and whatever else. So I remember smoking. But when I saw Grease, I know it sounds weird, but when I saw Grease, I had no idea it was a period film. Right. I thought that was America now. Right. And in an odd way with Bugsy Malone, I don't think I got the fact it was... I know it's clearly fabricated musical, whatever, but I think I just believe that world so much. And Grease, I definitely thought that was America.
Amazing.
At that time.
Yeah. Isn't that a beautiful thing if you just take it as
So I was very gullible. Yeah. I can't believe I even make films now because I was terribly gullible.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much
darling.
For spending
time. Good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
Well, she's just great, isn't she?
I know. You just feel totally great after hearing her.
I absolutely love her. I really loved her wish list of people that she'd like to work with, like Glenda Jackson, Kate Blanchett, Jodie Foster, all the greats.
Well, they would also be an ideal list for the podcast as well. So
yeah, okay.
Let's get that into the cosmos. Out of Blue is in cinemas on March 29th. I recommend you all go and see it if you can. And Carol's doing a tour all around the country with Q&A. So if you get to go to one of those screenings, I really recommend it because she is just an absolute joy.
So we've got another mini-sode coming up for you soon. But in the meantime, if you want to stay in touch with us or just chat to us about upcoming films, you can find us on Twitter at CinemaForAllPod. But in the meantime, let's roll credits.
Producer,
Jay Platt.
Logo designed by
Lydia Lipinski at Thoughts Make Things.
Hosted by
Jack Chell
and Abby Standish. With thanks to
Carol Morley, Alice Lumley and All Up Way to Blue, Deborah Parker, Sheffield Live and Andy and Ralph at the Showroom Cinema.
The Cinema for All podcast is supported by the BFI awarding funds from the National Lottery.
Thank you!